Hey, Christian, welcome back on the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I'm going to see the Lakers play the Wizards tonight, so I'm really stoked about that.
I'm very happy for you, Elias. I know nothing of... We're talking about basketball, right?
We are talking about basketball. Great. Yeah.
I hope you have a great time.
I hope so, too. Wow. Okay, that felt so flat, but welcome back to Safe Mode, everyone. We got Christian Vasquez, basketball fan number one, on the show today. We're going to be talking about some new cyber incident reporting rules that dropped from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And later on the show, we have an interview with Dave Itell, who's going to provide a hacker's perspective on Secure by Design. That's coming up on Safe Mode today.
Welcome to Safe Mode. I'm Elias Grohl, Senior Editor at CyberScoop. Every week, we break down the most pressing issues in technology, provide you the knowledge and the tools to stay ahead of the latest threats, and take you behind the scenes of the biggest stories in cybersecurity.
An attack is coming.
It's about keeping us safe.
He's just a disgruntled hacker.
She's a super hacker. Stay alert.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
This is Safe Mode.
I'm Elias Grohl. I'm the host of Safe Mode. Christian Vasquez, CyberScoop reporter. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So recently we got a package of proposed rules released by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Mm-hmm. These are rules around when critical infrastructure entities will have to report significant cybersecurity incidents.
Yes, sir.
Talk us through what CISA is trying to do and what the new rules are.
Sure. So essentially, after SolarWinds, the SolarWinds hack when Russia kind of hacked into a whole bunch of organizations, including several federal agencies, U.S. government kind of realized they do not have great visibility into the current cyber landscape. And a really easy example of that is, are ransomware attacks going up or down? We have no idea. That is very based on per company, which is based on what they have access to. So simple things like that, is it's hard to like make good policy. It's hard to make good decisions when you don't have a base for what is going on. So what this is, CERCIA, the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act of 2022, is essentially CISA requiring certain types of critical infrastructure organizations to essentially just report to them. Say, hey, if you got hit with a significant incident, let us know, you know, what was it? How did it go down? X, Y, and Z within 72 hours if it's a incident, and 24 hours if they pay a ransomware attack. And interestingly enough, it's also 72 hours if there was both an incident and they paid a ransomware attack. So that's essentially the bulk of the law.
So this all sounds really simple, but this document that we're talking about is something like 477 pages. Am I getting that number right? Was it 477?
447.
447.
Yes.
I should know this number. We've had it in all of our stories. Yeah, it's 447 pages long.
It's gigantic.
Yes. It's extremely complicated. So why is it requiring this massive set of rules to lay out a framework for critical infrastructure entities telling the federal government that they've been breached?
Right. I mean, it does sound simple, but I mean, so the actual rule in that gigantic document is actually not too, it's maybe a dozen or so pages, but the rest of it is literally just CISA's justification, what they're thinking about it. And I feel like that kind of really is because CISA's stepping into the regulatory role with industry, who generally do not want new regulations. And so they kind of have to say, okay, here's what we're thinking about. Here's how we're doing it. And kind of let us know what you think, because CISA really relies on the private sector for, you know, most of their work. And the kind of other aspect about this is it's really like the other aspect about this is just a draft, right? So on April the 4th is when this officially drops. CISA released like a draft or a preview essentially last week. And what that does is now organizations have 60 days to actually comment on this. And there are 16 different critical infrastructure sectors, a lot of different subsectors. There's going to be a lot of lawyers looking over, poring over all of this, making sure that we clearly define and the two biggest things are, what is a cyber incident? What is defined as a significant cyber incident? That depends on the industry. You know, if you're water facility versus healthcare, what impacts your operations is going to be a little bit different. And also, who is covered? Because critical infrastructure is a broad term. with most of organizations covered in some way or another. IT is a critical infrastructure. Snacks are actually a critical infrastructure subsector for food and ag. And so a lot of these are just laying out, if you are this, you can do it. If you are not this, you cannot do it. So generally, here's CISA just laid out a list using these things called sector-specific plans that are from 2015. They're very old, actually. And they're essentially when critical infrastructure was kind of coming around through the President Policy Directive 21, they essentially said, here's our plans to how we're going to fix or how we're going to secure our systems. CISA is using that and the little subsectors based on that as one aspect of it. The other aspect is kind of a size-based. So if you are a critical infrastructure sector within a certain size based on the Small Business Administration, you also have to report. So very long way of saying there's a lot of little nuances for how this should go when it's honestly just if you're in this line and if it's a significant enough incident, just tell us. That's essentially what it is.
So cybersecurity lawyers in Washington, D.C. are going to be billing a lot of hours through this. Summer houses are getting funded.
Oh, vacation.
With this.
The whole thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, multiple people I talked to were like, oh, we're still going through this.
Yep.
Days later.
Yep.
It's gigantic. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good life to get paid $400 an hour to to read a document. I wish that was my rate for reading documents.
We read a lot.
We read a lot of documents. Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the document itself and kind of some of the implications of it. CISA is going to be getting a huge amount of information through these reports. Industry is going to be generating a lot of data and providing it to CISA. As you alluded to, this is going to provide a better understanding of what cyber attacks are happening, their prevalence. We know kind of intuitively and anecdotally that cyber attacks are prevalent. Mm. Everybody's getting owned on a regular basis, but that's a very imprecise way of looking at the problem, right? So we're now going to get some hard numbers for how critical infrastructure entities are getting got. So does CISA have the ability to kind of take on this problem? What are folks telling you on that front?
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the bigger questions. I mean, so CISA does this already, right? There are existing laws for different critical infrastructure to report to, either an agency or CISA itself. It depends on each one. Again, we're talking about a lot of different types of organizations. So there's different authorities and different rules. So CISA already has that in place. However, they are drastically expanding it. And I think their estimate, and this is probably a conservative estimate, and it's probably wrong because, again, we don't have the information, is around 25,000 reports a year of significant cyber incidents.
Is what CISA is going to get under this new framework.
That's what they're assuming. Yeah. That's what they're working on assuming. So that's a lot of information. And, the technology exists to digest it, but I think the question is, can CISA take the information, analyze it, and then re-give it, that's a terrible way to say it, but essentially give it back out to the private sector in a way that's actionable and useful for them on time, right? So private sector, very, very long-standing complaint of they give information to the government and they don't really get anything back. And so CISA is going to really have to try to ensure that they can, right? And the other aspect of this is part of what CISA wants to do with this information is some incident response. Part of what they do is helping these organizations out if they don't have enough resources or whatever system can come in. They have their own incident response teams. They have enough for that. But it's not really clear how CISA is going to approach the IR aspect of this. Like, are companies going to have to ask CISA and then they go in? Or is CISA going to say, okay, this is a significant enough incident in critical infrastructure that might impact national security, all that jazz? And will they step in? So that's another question is how can they just spread those resources out? Do they have enough IR folk for that to actually happen? Mm. Do they have enough analysts to know each industry and know how to, ensure this is the best information to go out to this specific people in an actionable way? So again, these are things that CISA does. It's just being drastically increased and they had budget cuts from Congress. So that's another aspect of this. CISA has become much more of a controversial agency from right-wing folks. So that's kind of, it could harm this. We don't know yet, but, you know, in a media call last week, a senior CISA official basically told us that they have budget cuts, they're looking at it, and they think they can pull it off still. But, you know, it kind of remains to be seen.
Okay. Christian, thank you so much for your reporting on this. We will continue to cover the implementation of this, I'm sure. And we'll be back on the show to tell us about it.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks, Christian. Coming up next on Safe Mode, I'm joined by the veteran cybersecurity executive, Dave Eitel, to talk about the Biden administration's centerpiece cybersecurity initiative, Secure by Design. Dave Eitel has spent his career building secure systems and figuring out how to break into them, and he joins the show to give a hacker's view on Secure by Design. That's up next on Safe Mode. If you go to any major information security conference today, chances are you'll run into some official from the Biden administration touting their Secure by Design initiative. That initiative aims to build more secure hardware and software by prioritizing security in the design process and asks developers to rethink how they approach building products. So can it be done? My guest today is Dave Eitel, who spent 6 years at the National Security Agency before founding the security firm Immunity. He's currently the head of the security consulting firm Cordyceps Systems. Dave Eitel, welcome to Safe Mode.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great having you on the show. I feel like I started talking to you when I was getting started on the cybersecurity beat like 10 years ago. And one of the things I really appreciated about those early conversations with you was that you were able to really marry the technical implications of like the various policy initiatives that I was covering at the time, and trying to really critically assess, you know, whether kind of the policy and the technical side of things really meshed up, which is a hard challenge. So I'm looking forward to kind of getting into all of that today and talking a bit about the Secure by Design initiative. So I kind of want to start off just by asking you to level set a bit with listeners who maybe have heard of the Secure by Design initiative but might not be super familiar with it. Like, what is it? What's it trying to achieve?
Well, I mean, what's it trying to achieve and what is it are two very different things, as with many policy functions. But I think the best initial introduction to Secure by Design is that it is an effort by what I'll call thought leaders at CISA, the government agency who is sort of the most forward-leaning and customer-focused around information security right now. And the goal is, realistically, to decrease by, you know, 90% the number of vulnerabilities that we are having to deal with on a regular basis, particularly in critical infrastructure, which is where CISA has a major focus. But, you know, globally across the software industry as well. And there's a lot that goes into that. But that if you had to, like, ask them to summarize what their goals are, That's basically what they say. And I think the great thing about that is that you can ask them what their goals are, and that is what they will say. And so one of the things I did, you know, while analyzing, you know, this effort, this large, very large government effort, which has a lot to it, was, you know, message Bob Lord and say, hey, do you have 15 minutes and can I ask you some dumb questions? And I don't think it's hard to say that this is a new thing, really, for government, like especially in the cybersecurity space. You know, when you and I first started looking at this stuff, you know, things were a lot more closed in. And now things are much more open, right? Like, you can message government officials and be like, how do I fit into your picture? And the government officials involved are also very different, right? So it used to be they were all lawyers, like top to bottom. If you looked at the administration officials and previous admins, you're going to get lawyers. Bob Lord's not a lawyer, and Bob Lord is one of the people, I would call him the progenitor of the Secure by Design push. A few other things about it that I thought were really interesting. It's a hugely international effort in a way that you don't often see. So you'll see like the Japanese cybersecurity branch sign on to U.S. government policies in this area. And you'll see huge coalitions, like massive, like coalitions. Some of these were like agencies I didn't even realize existed in other governments signing on to this as a coalition and citing like White House papers around memory safety, for example. So I would say it's international. It's extremely broad. It's part of a whole of government approach to changing the scale of how we deal with information security and software as a whole. And it's very interesting. So for all your listeners, I would say this is actually something interesting to look at.
So yeah, let's get into the details a little bit. What are the specific levers that they're trying to pull with this? How are they trying to achieve, you know, trying to achieve these major gains in computer security?
So I think major gains in computer security are not won easily. And what you're looking at is a lot of discussion. First, it is about understanding what direction to march in and who needs to march in that direction. And that's where things are getting a little complicated already. But if you look at sort of the levers that can be pulled, the government as a whole has regulatory levers. They have sort of transparency levers where they can sort of enforce information disclosure. And they have, you know, communications levers. And I think what you'll see with the current administration and the current team at CISA is, I think rightfully so, they're focused on the communication lever as much as possible while preparing the road for regulatory and legislative levers they can pull later. So the reality of what CISA is doing right now is like an insane bullhorn treadmill of like outreach. So if you've been to a conference, you've seen a CISA team getting feedback, trying to explain their positions, you know, explaining the return on investment for this policy. And I think it's useful to think about this as a return on investment discussion, because these things are not free or cheap. And at the same time, trying to figure out the next step forward with available stakeholders. So one of the elements of that is essentially trying to sell a legislative solution to some of these things, to try to build a new regulatory agency, perhaps, which is one of the ideas that they've proposed, and probably the idea that I would say is unlikely to happen as long as there's a single Republican alive in Congress. And then maybe the second one is they're trying to, like, what executive, you know, orders can they put forth that would start to move these things forward? So the other big idea everyone is trying to push is software liabilities. And the idea there is to try to move the burden of essentially all of software security, but especially of incidents, from the end user of the software, aka the tiny utility company that is a for-profit company sitting somewhere in, I don't know, you know, outskirts of some random city, from them onto the software manufacturers, who are these big multinational companies that produce all the software and hardware that these people use. So
yeah.
There's been a lot of legal discussion. The White House just had a legal, like a law professor summit at the White House, where everyone discussed all of their possibilities in terms of, you know, how can we massage tort law? And by massage, I mean truly distort it into giving us software liabilities. What are the possibilities for a safe harbor? How do we, you know, determine who's actually liable? Honestly, there aren't, and I'm just going to throw the conclusion out here, like right in the front of the podcast. There are no good ideas in the law community. There's nothing new, and there's nothing really good when it comes down to how to implement this stuff. And I apologize if that kind of is spoiler alert. But if you know, if you want to TLDR this podcast, there's no good ideas with software liability, and it's a hard problem. What it could be my TLDR.
So, yeah, I want to get into your thoughts on software liability. I know you have a lot of them, or maybe just one simple one that it doesn't work. But I want to get into why you think that is. And I think, as I understand the software liability conversation right now, a lot of it, you know, the central idea is that you are going to be, that large software providers are going to be exempt from liability as long as they abide by a set of secure software development norms. And this is something that the administration is trying to push industry towards, to try to adopt software development standards, norms that are more secure. You know, recently we had a secure software development attestation form come out from CISA. And I'm wondering, first off, like trying to understand like what software is secure and how it becomes secure seems like a really hard technical problem. So like maybe wanted to start you off on that. Like as somebody who's on the front lines of trying to secure systems, like can we figure out like when software is secure?
No. I mean, we can't. Like if you were to take, I had a great hacker whose name I will not release, talk to me about this. And she said, when I look at a piece of software, it's like being in literature class and rereading Shakespeare and then trying to come up with just a new interpretation of it. That's something that other people haven't thought of. And that's like at the core of the problem of some of this is that, you know, everything looks obvious in retrospect. And so what you have is you have a lot of lawyers when they're trying to build software liabilities, and they're like, well, you should never have a buffer overflow in your software. Why would you ever have something so severely wrong with your software? Your software must not have gone through a good process of development, right? So that's what you would think. Like, it's very hard to get them out of that perspective. It's like, yeah, obviously in retrospect, I don't want that in my software. And I'm really sad that it happened. And all my customers are sad as well. But when I was building the software, I didn't do that on purpose, right? So it's very hard to draw the line between I'm bad at what I do, or there's an honest mistake, or there's actual gross negligence, which is really where you want to have sort of legal line. I think, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is sort of the idea that there's a process that you go through, and out of that process comes better software. But of course, the gold standard for this process has always been Microsoft. And no one on earth is going to say that Microsoft software is without its security weaknesses, right? So,
yeah.
And I think that's really, it really shows you the ceiling of our socio-technological capability to build software at a level of security that we feel is should be at. And so I'm not a law professor, but every time a law professor tells you they want to put liability and use a process that is not meant as a legal standard to determine the limits or the length of that liability, you have to be pretty scared. Like that is some of the process. Okay, just to give you a broad sweep of the proposals that are out there for this software liability problem. People have proposed that if you have a vulnerability that's in the common weaknesses enumeration, that you should be liable. And they've also proposed that the safe haven could be if you're SOC 2 certified, then you should have a safe haven up to a certain level. They've said, oh, if you're following like some NIST standards, you should have also a safe harbor. None of these things were meant as legal standards, right? Like they're not, you know, one of the most recent ones about if you get certified, if you had like a certification, you should be fine. And the government will certify certifications as being the right way to do things. Most of those certifications they're very broad process, they're almost maturity models. They're really not meant for like, let's tie a legal yes, no process on this. And what you end up with is all these things, if they did this, would go to court forever. And it would result in conflicting results all over the country. And it would just realistically be who had the most money to pay lawyers. And that means you're building a kind of a software standard where only the very largest companies can really afford to build software. So I think all of these things, like looking at, first of all, I've read all the law papers about this and none of them are good. And secondarily, it's, you know, people, I get why people want this. Like, it's very understandable when you see the sort of simple, horrible vulnerabilities in, you know, let's just say Pulse Secure, which also known as Avanti, right? So if you have Avanti out there and you're like, why does this have a vulnerability that is just so horrendous that even CISA is getting hacked by it? Like, yeah, you get the frustration and you also get the understanding that the US government doesn't want to be on the hook for paying for everybody to get their like security up to where it needs to be. Like, the only way for the U.S. government to afford to be able to do anything here is for the industry to take the financial hit, to do the security work themselves. That said, software liability, you know, I'm not like a big software guy, right? Like, I've never worked for Microsoft or Google or any of these companies. I don't work for the, you know, their lobbying firm. I just don't think this is a good idea.
So I just want to play devil's advocate for a little bit. You know, it seems to me like even if a kind of this type of process-based approach doesn't actually, you know, it doesn't solve the problem conclusively, perhaps it would give us some a bit of, like, you know, marginal gains in terms of software security if, you know, we required big software vendors to follow a certain set of procedures in their you know, development processes. Then, you know, maybe we could get security gains. Maybe, you know, if we subjected a certain set of, you know, widely used software to, I don't know, formal methods or you know, some extremely advanced yet to be developed, you know, AI scanning tool that would, you know, input all of the code in a piece of software and examine that for, you know, known vulnerabilities, which I think is probably something that already exists already. So, like, do you see an opportunity here for, you know, some marginal gains if we were to adopt any of these ideas, or are you just kind of entirely skeptical of the concept?
No, it's not going to work. But I will say that having your idea is good. Having a tool of some kind, like a literal oracle that could tell you the difference between secure and unsecure processes or secure and unsecure software, that would be a fantastic thing to have around for a legal standard. Because we could say, oh, if you shipped it and you ran it through our oracle and it said your stuff's insecure, then you know, you should be liable. The problem is that building that oracle it's sort of like that is lawyers pushing the actual difficulty of the problem onto the technology community in a way that the technology community has no way to pick up. So it's sort of like, it actually kind of reminds me of the key escrow problem in that sense. They're like, well, why don't you just build a secure key escrow? And all the technologists were like, because we can't, because it's not possible. Because, like, they have a lot of weaknesses and it's very expensive to even consider, you know, and like, so there's sort of like, of course, there's a desire to just make it the technologist's problem. And, you know, putting my technologist hat on, I just don't see a clear path to any level of success. It doesn't mean like the DARPA AI, like there's a challenge right now that Perry Helen's running over at DARPA, which is literally trying to invent that AI oracle, right? Like, I want to find, you know, vulnerabilities and automatically patch them using AI, using whatever the most modern tool set is, so that we're not stuck in the 90s, right? Like, that, all of that stuff is a very interesting technological exploratory journey. It's just not something that you want to try to, like, put into law right now. And what we have is, unfortunately, a lot of political pressure to get stuff done immediately, right? So, like, people are like, this might be our window to actually move the ball. So we need to push anything out that does anything, any executive order at any cost, is kind of the marching discussion from a lot of people.
Yeah, I guess we should be clear with listeners that the proposal to put in place a software liability standard is one that the administration has described in its cybersecurity strategy, but it is one that would require an act of Congress to put in place. And there are currently no proposals on the table in Congress to pass such a measure. And even if there were, it's unclear that the Congress would actually be able to do so.
I think it's been very interesting. I just, from people who are obsessed with DC politics, and I always love to read between the tea leaves, which I think is, you know, your audience and also me, because I grew up in D.C. and I'm also obsessed. And so, like, the White House communication on these issues has really been fascinating. So they will not say that they're committed to pushing forward software liabilities. They are committed to looking at it. And so, you know, so their line in the sand is, did we or did we not look at the issue? And they had a big legal symposium. Literally, I think they announced a press release yesterday. It's currently the 28th, so 27th, they released something. And they said, we've brought a bunch of lawyers together and we've had a good discussion. And now we're going to take it to the stakeholders and technologists and see what they say in terms of implementation potentials. And I think if I had to read between the tea leaves, it might be, we don't necessarily think it's going to work either, but, we'll throw it out there. And that's mission accomplished in some senses.
Mm. Okay. Well, we're going to try to figure out, I think, a little bit more what happened with that symposium, and we'll report back when we've maybe gotten some answers on that. Maybe we'll try to get some of the law professors on the show who were in the building for that meeting. I want to turn a bit to memory safety, which is another component of the Secure by Design initiative. The White House wants to, and CISA wants to, try to eliminate entire classes of bugs by pushing the adoption of so-called memory safe programming languages. What does that transition look like from where you sit in a more technical chair, of moving away from, I guess, for lack of a better term, traditional programming languages and towards memory safe ones like Rust?
I love that your audience understands what Rust is, but
I hope they do. Well, do you want to explain what Rust is?
Well, Rust is another language where the compiler strictly guarantees memory safety unless you've told it not to. But it does that by cutting the amount of things it can do down and avoiding the use of, what in C would be pointers. The concept is actually pretty complicated, right? So there's lots of memory safe languages out there. There's often just not a memory safe language that you want to use. If that makes any sense. So the White House was really interesting in their memory safety, like the ONCD's paper, because they're like, in space systems, aka satellites, missiles, other critical systems like that, they're like, you won't be able to use Java because you need certain reliabilities in timing and in resource consumption. And so instead, your options realistically are C, C++, and Rust, which are all low level enough that they're going to give you those reliabilities. Now, out of those three, C and C++ are the only ones that you could actually do anything in. Even if we're trying to build like a high security system, there's just not like a Rust, like real-time operating system that you're going to use. Like there isn't one available. And, even then, I don't know of anybody building space systems using Rust. The other weird thing about that is that space systems are not the only type of system where you need those guarantees, right? So those guarantees are also the same guarantees you want in a video game, right? I need time safety and resource constraints. And they're also the same ones I have like writing my kernel, right? So like my operating system is written in C and C++. And then they're trying to, like, you see Microsoft and Linux playing with Rust a little bit, but it's not a wholesale thing. And the other issue, obviously, is that Rust is a little bit more complicated to program in. And I know that Rust aficionados are already emailing me right now. But it is a little bit difficult, right? Like, the guarantee of getting it right from the compiler can be, like, it can be, like, I have to use my computer science education when I do some of that work. So, and Rust is great, but it's not, Here, let me also point out this, is that like most of the vulnerabilities we've been having lately are really in managed memory safe languages, right? So, when you're owning Exchange, you're owning a memory safe language. And some of those were the biggest, SharePoint, Exchange, these were some of the biggest vulnerabilities of last year. If you look at all the VPNs that are getting owned, it's not because, well, except for FortiGate, but all the other ones, it's because they actually have like Perl and like horrible other memory safe languages, but that should never be on your router, right? So it's not necessarily about memory safety if you're trying to just globally increase, like you shouldn't have PHP on your router at all. And one of the other things that's feeding into this is, of course, the SBOM initiative, also from like CISA and NIST. If you know, have Alan Friedman, I'm sure you've had him on your podcast at one point.
I've interviewed Alan, but he hasn't been on the show. The For listeners who might not be aware, SBOM is the Software Bill of Materials Initiative. The idea is that you would get a bill of materials for software that tells you what software components are in it so that when vulnerabilities are discovered, you are better aware of whether the various components that make up your software package contain any vulnerable programs. But go ahead, Dave.
Well, I think that the interesting thing about SBOMs is it's very much a concrete technical a process that is easier said than done. But the goal is very obvious, right? It's sort of very simple to explain. You're like, if a vulnerability comes out in log4j, I want to be able to look at my enterprise and find out which pieces of my enterprise have log4j in them. And that should be a very simple question. There's a lot of issues, but those issues are actually getting worked through by various teams within industry and government when it comes to answering those questions in a way that makes sense. And that's sort of like, that's a part, honestly, it is a part of secure by design, is like understanding what's in your systems is a part of secure by design. And if being able to query that data in a reliable way is a part of the fact is, if you knew that PHP was running on your router, you should have thrown the router into the sea. Like that should never have happened. And, you know, like the Ivanti stuff, you know, I think the vulnerability was in a PHP component, which it's just embarrassing at that point. So I think there's lots of room in these processes. First of all, the first thing that CIS is doing is alerting people to all this stuff constantly. At any level of technological sophistication, you're getting an alert for your level of sophistication. So if you're just starting, they're like, here's your starter booklet. And if you're like a pretty sophisticated consumer, they're like, here's an XML document with the, you know, specific feed that you need and a, you know, and a discussion group with all of your peers, right? So I think that all of those processes together, I think the thing I've liked about looking at this the most is that it is a whole of government approach. And you don't see those that often. In fact, I don't know if I've seen another one.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about the initiative is just how wide-ranging it is. And I want to touch on the transparency component of it, which I think is what you're referring to here. And, you know, one of the components of the transparency initiative is the cybersecurity labeling initiative. So basically, if you go out and buy a, you know, Internet of Things device, a, you know, smart fridge, toaster, a thermostat, whatever, that you have some sense of the security quality of the product that you're buying. It's kind of modeled after the Energy Star initiative that gives you as a consumer information about devices, energy consumption. With the IoT labeling program, the idea is that you as a consumer are going to know about the security specification and quality of the product that you're buying. The hope being that folks start voting, or rather consumers start voting with their wallets and spend money on more secure devices. I'm wondering just what you think of that initiative and like what kinds of security gains we might reasonably expect from it.
I think one thing that's, for me, at least important to look at when looking at that kind of initiative is, who doesn't like it? And the issue with this particular one is that everybody likes it. And when everybody likes a labeling initiative, it's kind of hard to say that it's going to give consumers the information they need to properly make these decisions. Or companies have realized that consumers are not going to look up that information and are not going to make decisions based on it. And so they like it too much, is my feeling on this one. And I could be completely wrong, because maybe it will have the exact effect. You know, I don't think every time the government needs to wield a hammer, they need to be smashing stuff through the wall, right? So this can be a very light pressure to sort of give companies some basic guidelines on, you know, these are the things that would make up a secure IoT device. And if we put it in a label, you're going to be able to put, you know, AAA star government USG rated in that label, and it's going to look good. So what if you just, you know, just go ahead and take out the default passwords? That'd be awesome. And at that point, everyone has the same label, right? So it's a little bit like that Dr. Seuss book where everyone has a little star on their belly button. And that's great, because it had its desired effect. When it comes to having bigger effects, like this market shaping sort of decision making effects in that case, I don't know yet. And I think everyone's idea is, well, it's worth a shot because the cost is low enough that, you know, it's if it has any effect, that's good enough in some cases.
But even just having encouraging device manufacturers to, you know, give consumers the ability to change a default password, I think that would probably make a big difference.
It could, yeah. It 100% could. And it may be the easiest way to get, you know, a very particular niche of manufacturers to do the right thing. And I think if you talk to the CISA team, they will say, we understand that this is not one market. It's huge. There's no one size fits all solution. And this may be the exact right, you know, solution for one small niche of the market. And I think we will see.
Yeah, the proof will be in the pudding. So I want to kind of step back a little bit and think more broadly as we end. Yeah, the idea of this initiative is to try to shift responsibility of, or rather shift the economic burden of breaches away from consumers and governments who are suffering them and onto the makers of hardware and software. And, you know, as we've discussed, there's many technical challenges in doing that. I'm wondering if, you know, there are any changes you would like to see to try to shift that burden. Are there some kind of policy level levers that we can try to pull that aren't being pulled right now that you would like to see?
There definitely are, but let me just correct one thing that you said, which is this is not about breaches. It realistically is about the entire security lifecycle. So if you had to install like an intrusion detection system to look at that one piece of hardware that you had to buy and man that intrusion detection system and, you know, invest in software security assessments of your own, like that is all burden that is being placed on you, the consumer, from the manufacturer, and should really have been something you didn't have to worry about. Like if you have to manage patches, vulnerabilities, you know, if you have a Tenable or a Qualys subscription where you have to look at these things, that is a price, that you, literal price that you paid to manage other people's problems. So I think I just want to, and I'm not saying this as me, I'm saying this is what CISA and the thought leaders of the team are presenting as part of the problem. So, and I think it's important. But in terms of like, you know, are there other levers? Yeah, there's a ton of levers that you could pull. There's no reason to patch software that is critical and has critical weaknesses and then keep it on your network. And I think this is one of the biggest mistakes that CISA is making right now with their communications, is the idea that, you know, there's been a critical vulnerability in something. We know the Chinese have had an exploit for it for 2 years, and we're hoping that you patch it and that, you know, it should stay on your network as if they haven't already hacked you months ago and put a Trojan on that box in a way that you'll never be able to remove, right? So a while back, one of these appliances got hacked and they literally said, take the boxes that you're running on your network and just ship them to us or to the local landfill because those are trash now. And that's often the only solution. And there's other stuff happening as well. I mean, I think this would require a legislative discussion, but right now in the end user license agreements, if a security researcher wants to do, or even performance analysis, wants to do an analysis of a piece of hardware or software, they're not allowed to publish that stuff. So if I was like looking at, you know, one of the big vendors, and I'm not going to name any names, and I said, this is terrible, no one should run this, it's awful, it's my opinion, but, you know, by the way, here's all the things I found that are in it, I can't publish that or I'll get sued. Like, and they will win and I will lose my house, right? So that can all be changed. And I think it's very interesting that, like, it's probably going to be easier to change that level of transparency than it would be to implement some of these, you know, much heavier requirements. But one of the benefits of, you know, the secure by design stuff is that it's everything and nothing at the same time, right? So it's flexible. And when they see that something isn't working, there's room to pivot. There's room to like look at some of these other solutions and try to bring in other people to say, oh, instead of doing software liabilities, we're going to do, we're going to do a, a safe haven for vulnerability researchers if they discover an issue with products, every product, right? So there's so many other possibilities. I don't want to go through a big list of them right now, because that'll annoy your listeners. But I think it's worth knowing that there are other options. It's not just please change default passwords and software liabilities, even though those are currently the, visible thrusts in many cases.
Well, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't changed your default passwords, change your default passwords. Dave, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's great to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Safe Mode, a weekly podcast on cybersecurity and digital privacy brought to you by CyberScoop. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and a review and share it with your friends, your mom, your dad. Nobody wants to get hacked. To find out more information or to contact me, your host, please visit cyberscoop.com.